All right, so we are going to start week 6 in this book, and it's called Belshazzar's Feast, and so it covers all of Daniel chapter 5. And before I start reading chapter 5, I actually wanted to start with the last verse in chapter 4, which is Nebuchadnezzar speaking, in Daniel chapter 4, verse 37. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, for all his works are right and his ways are just, and those who walk in pride he's able to humble. And now on to chapter 5. King Belshazzar made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords and drank wine in front of 1,000. Belshazzar, when he tasted the wine, commanded that the vessels of gold and of silver that Nebuchadnezzar his father had taken out of the temple in Jerusalem be brought, that the king and his lords, his wives, and his concubines might drink from them. Then he brought in the golden vessels that had been taken out of the temple, the house of God in Jerusalem, and the king and his lords, his wives, and his concubines drank from them. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold and silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone. Immediately, the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace opposite the lampstand. And the king saw the hand as it wrote. Then the king's color changed, and his thoughts alarmed him. His limbs gave way, and his knees knocked together. The king called loudly to bring in the enchanters, the Chaldeans, and the astrologers. The king declared to the wise men of Babylon, "Whoever reads this writing and shows me its interpretation shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around his neck, and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom." Then all the king's wise men came in, but they could not read the writing or make known to the king the interpretation. Then King Belshazzar was greatly alarmed, and his color changed, and his lords were perplexed. The queen, because of the words of the king and his lords, came into the banqueting hall, and the queen declared, "O king, live forever. Let not your thoughts alarm you or your color change. There is a man in your kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. In the days of your father, light and understanding and wisdom like the wisdom of the gods were found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father the king, made him chief of the magicians, enchanters, Chaldeans, and astrologers, because an excellent spirit, knowledge, and understanding to interpret dreams, explain riddles, and solve problems were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar. Now let Daniel be called, and he will show the interpretation." Then Daniel was brought in before the king. The king answered and said to Daniel, "You are that Daniel, one of the exiles of Judah, whom the king, my father, brought from Judah. I have heard of you that the spirit of the gods is in you, and that light and understanding and excellent wisdom are found in you. Now the wise men, the enchanters, have brought in before me to read this writing and make known to me its interpretation. But they could not show the interpretation of the matter. But I have heard that you can give interpretations and solve problems. Now, if you can read the writing and make known to me its interpretation, you shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around your neck and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom." Then Daniel answered and said before the king, "Let your gifts be for yourself and give your rewards to another. Nevertheless, I'll read the writing to the king and make known to him the interpretation. O king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar, your father, kingship and greatness and glory and majesty. And because of the greatness that he gave him, all peoples, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him. Whom he would, he killed, and whom he would, he kept alive. Whom he would, he raised up, and whom he would, he humbled. But when his heart was lifted up and his spirit was hardened, so that he dealt proudly, he was brought down from his kingly throne, and his glory was taken from him. He was driven from among the children of mankind, and his mind was made like that of a beast, and his dwelling was with the wild donkeys. He was fed grass like an ox, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven, until he knew that the Most High God rules the kingdom of mankind and sets over it whom he will. And you, his son, Belteshazzar, have not humbled your heart, though you knew all this, but you have lifted up yourself against the Lord of heaven. And the vessels of his house have been brought in before you, and you and your lords, your wives, and your concubines have drunk wine from them. And ye have praised the gods of silver and gold, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone, which do not see or hear or know, but the God in whose hand is your breath, and whose all are all your ways, you have not honored. Then from his presence the hand was sent, and this writing was inscribed. And this is the writing that was inscribed: Mene, Mene, Tekel, and Parsin. This is the interpretation of the matter. Mene, God has numbered the days of your kingdom and brought it to an end. Tekel, you have weighed in the balances, you have been weighed in the balances and found wanting. Peres, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians. Then Belshazzar gave the command, and Daniel was clothed with purple, a chain of gold was put around his neck, and a proclamation was made about him, that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. That very night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was killed, and Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. All right. So the whole, like, the last verse that we read from chapter 4, which is the last we hear from Nebuchadnezzar, and how he says, those who walk in pride, he's able to humble. I feel like that's kind of the summary of all of chapter 5. And so before we get to our book and the questions in there, there were a couple of things that I guess Mr. Wilson threw in. So we want to answer these questions, but the second part of the first section, he says, Belshazzar was not literally Nebuchadnezzar's son. And then also in the third section, he starts out the question saying the queen mother entered the chamber. So when we're reading, it actually says, you know, he calls him the son, and then it also calls Nebuchadnezzar's father. And also it says just the queen. So it kind of threw me off when I was reading his questions, like, why is he calling him not literally the son and the queen mother? So if you actually see in your Bibles, so in verse 2, it says, Belshazzar, when he tasted the wine, commanded that the vessels of gold and of silver that Nebuchadnezzar his father, and then there's a footnote, 1, and down below it should say, our predecessor. And also the same thing down in verse 10, it starts out saying the queen, and there should be a footnote number 3, which says queen mother. So typically I never read footnotes unless it's like a word that I've never encountered before, but in these it's actually very helpful. And actually if we turn to Jeremiah chapter 27, Jeremiah 27:7, it says, here's talking about Nebuchadnezzar. All the nations shall serve him and his son and his grandson until the time of his own land comes. Then many nations and great kings shall make him their slave. So one of the commentators is saying how it's implying here that Belshazzar was probably the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar. And also what we know is that both the Hebrew and Aramaic words for son and father is kind of much broader than like the literal son. So it could be like a son, a grandson, or just in general like a descendant. And in the same way, the grandfather, father could be a grandfather or an ancestor. And also the descendant doesn't have to be an actual literal descendant. It could also be, you know, whoever took over the throne after that person. And we see this in other places in the Bible, like Jesus is called the son of David, the son of Abraham. He's not actually literally their son. And also, if you read like the Narnia stories, you know, they call those kids the son of Adam and daughter of Eve. So we will get into kind of the history of Babylon and why, where Belshazzar fits in. And also, real quickly about the queen. So it does say early in the chapter that when he's having the feast, he has all his wives and his concubines. So if all his wives and his concubines are already there, that means the queen's already there. So when this lady enters in, after she kind of sees the commotion going on, she is the queen mother, who's most likely the wife of his dad. And if he is the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar, she's probably the daughter of Nebuchadnezzar, which kind of explains why she remembers all of the events from the previous parts of Daniel. She actually remembers what happened when Nebuchadnezzar was king. And she actually has a very important role in the story. She's the reason why Daniel's being brought in. And I felt like she kind of reminds me of the story of Naaman and the servant girl who kind of introduces, like, hey, there's this great man, and he can help you. And, right. So why is Belshazzar not Nebuchadnezzar's son, and how does that fit in? Because we kind of see a big jump from chapter 4, where it's talking about Nebuchadnezzar and what he learned, and then without any explanation, chapter 5 just starts with King Belshazzar. So we know that he's not Nebuchadnezzar's son. So what we know from the history books is that Nebuchadnezzar has a son called Emel-Marduk, or some other historians call him Evil Marduk, which is not a fun name. And this guy was king. So Nebuchadnezzar, so if remember, we were talking in chapter 4 about kind of the timeline for chapter 4, whether if that was in like the middle of Nebuchadnezzar's reign or maybe towards the end. Nebuchadnezzar was king for 43 years. And then his son, Evil Marduk, took over. And he was only king for less than 2 years. And he was assassinated by his brother-in-law. His brother-in-law was Nergal-Sharezer. And that guy ruled for 4 years. And after that, he had a son who took over, and he was killed in less than a month by, I guess, another son-in-law of Nebuchadnezzar, who was called Nabonidus. And so for what we know is we believe that Belshazzar was Nabonidus' son. And this Nabonidus... So even though Belshazzar is not the actual son of Nebuchadnezzar, he very much wants to be like the spiritual son of Nebuchadnezzar. So there's this kind of like, so Belshazzar ruled for 43 years, and then you have this like 6 to 7 year period where there are like multiple people, and there's a lot of, you know, there are like a couple of coups, and there's a lot of instability, and Belshazzar is kind of, you know, looking to be like, you know, I'm continuing Nebuchadnezzar's legacy, and I'm kind of restoring Babylon's greatness. And so another problem was that Belshazzar was actually not found in the Babylonian history books. So like their own history, and the Greeks were writing the Babylonian history like, you know, a few centuries later. Their kind of the lineage of kings stopped with Nabonidus. And most of the history books said that Nabonidus was the king at the time Babylon, the empire, ended. So this made a lot of scholars kind of, they were doubting the accuracy of Daniel. So they were saying, you know, so Daniel obviously made a, you know, big mistake here, and so they were using this as one of the reasons why we shouldn't doubt the rest of the book, and, you know, the prophecies are probably written after those events actually came to happen. But then in the 19th century, like 1854, 55, there was a big archaeological discovery where they were digging up stuff in Babylonian ruins, where they actually found something that had Belshazzar mentioned, and that's the first time we found anything that actually had Belshazzar mentioned. And so what we know from now, so after we kind of have a more updated history, is that Belshazzar and Nabonidus were kind of co-regents. And so Nabonidus was the one who became king, but then he left Belshazzar in charge of the city of Babylon. So he was kind of the emperor of the greater Babylonian empire, and then Belshazzar is the king in charge of Babylon. And they say there are kind of a couple of different reasons for that. One was that, you know, Babylon was this huge empire, and Nabonidus was kind of handling things at large when Belshazzar was, you know, he left his son in charge of the city. And especially during this time when, you know, we see the Persian invasion at the end of the chapter. So the Persians have been attacking them, and he's kind of going out there taking care of things, and he left his son in charge. And then there's also another thing where Nabonidus was into the moon god Sin, rather than Marduk, or they also call Marduk Bel. So that's why we have Belshazzar, and Daniel's Babylonian name is Belteshazzar. So traditionally, the Babylonians, the most prominent god was Marduk, but then this guy who became king was into this other god, Sin. So the priestly class, the priests weren't very happy with that. And, you know, this is back in the day, there's no, like, separation of church and state. So the priests were, like, ready to revolt. So the kind of the compromise that came up with is, you know, send the king out, They kind of sent him kind of almost like in a pilgrimage, like out there, out to like Arabia or somewhere, where he can kind of, you know, do his thing with the moon god, and Belteshazzar can rule in his place. So that's why a lot of the official documents, it still says Nabonidus did this, Nabonidus did that. But Daniel was kind of pretty much the only document we had where Belteshazzar was doing all these things. And up until the 19th century, you know, there were still big incongruence going on, but then we found out that, you know, Daniel was true. Which, and another thing where this makes sense is that when the king hands out the reward for interpretation, he says that you'll be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around your neck, and you'll be the third ruler in the kingdom, which makes sense when the dad is Nabonidus is the first ruler, Belteshazzar is the second ruler, and whoever can help with this problem will become the third ruler. And also, just in general, this reinforces the fact that, you know, there's really nothing in the Bible that we have disproven with, you know, history or archaeology. It's just we are missing pieces, and eventually, you know, we'll probably get to it. That so, and it just reinforces just my faith in the just the Word of God. All right. So, does anyone remember kind of where we set chapter 4 in? Kind of, what did we decide? Like, what was the age of Daniel when chapter 4 was going on? Like, chapter 4, like, in the whole Nebuchadnezzar. Well, 80s was his end of his life, like, when the Persians took over. But, like, chapter 4 is kind of in the middle of Nebuchadnezzar's reign. Yeah, it was probably around his 30s or 40s. So, yeah, Daniel. Yeah, so Daniel was in his 30s or 40s. So now we're done with Nebuchadnezzar's story. And depending on kind of where we put chapter 4, whether it was in the middle of Nebuchadnezzar's reign or towards his end, Nebuchadnezzar reigned probably around like 20 more years or 10 to 20 more years. And then you have the 6 to 7 years of instability. And then we have 17 years of Nabonidus / Belteshazzar reigning. And chapter 5 is the kind of the last year of his reign, well, essentially the last day of his reign. So if you do that, we essentially have a time jump of like 30 to 40 years, which means Daniel is now in his 80s. For an 80-year-old, he comes in there and he saves the day, and Daniel died probably looks really works because he still is going strong. I kind of picture him, maybe because my kids are into Toy Story now, I kind of picture him as the guy in Toy Story 2 where Woody's hand breaks and this old guy comes in and he fixes him and taking care of his thing. So one of the reasons for, you know, all these jumps, because chapter 4 itself was a big jump from chapter 3, and then now we have another jump, and there's all these like kind of incongruous with history. Is that, Daniel's purpose here is he's not writing Babylon's history. You know, his point of this book is to kind of nourish the faith of the exiles so that his point is to show that, you know, God's still in control. And these are just a collection of stories that, you know, that's the result. And he's not necessarily writing like the sequential thing, every single thing that happened. And we already knew that Babylon was ending in the beginning of Daniel in chapter 1. The end of chapter 1, he says that how Daniel was there until the first year of King Cyrus. And King Cyrus is the Persian king. So we already know from chapter 1 that, you know, this end is coming and now it's here. All right. So any questions on kind of the history, the timeline? All right, so we can probably go into our books now. All right, so week 6, I'm reading in page 43. All right, so this is the place of the passage. In Daniel chapter 5, we're introduced to Babylon's last monarch, Belshazzar, and this brought chronologically to the end of the Babylonian Empire. The chapter describes the events of a great feast hosted by Belshazzar. It's a show of royal power, bounty, and self-satisfaction. Ironically, in the middle of the feast, Belshazzar is confronted with the message of divine judgment, the writing on the wall. And that very night, he loses his life when the city and thus empire is overtaken by Darius the Mede. And the big picture is that this chapter teaches the sober truth that sometimes people can become so hardened that they're beyond the point of redemption, so that the only thing remaining for them is judgment. All right, so I guess we can go on to the first question, the idolatrous feast. So I can read those four verses again before we tackle that question. All right, so King Belshazzar made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords and drank wine in front of the 1,000. Belshazzar, when he tasted the wine, commanded that the vessels of gold and of silver that Nebuchadnezzar, his father, had taken out of the temple in Jerusalem be brought, that the king and his lords, his wives, and his concubines might drink from them. Then they brought in the golden vessels that had been taken out of the temple, the house of God in Jerusalem, and the king and his lords, his wives, and his concubines drank from them. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold and silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone. All right, so the question here is, Belshazzar is enjoying a lavish feast for many, many guests. He decides, however, to drink wine out of the vessels of gold and silver bought from the temple in Jerusalem. And the reference here is back to chapter 1, verse 2, where when Nebuchadnezzar is conquering Jerusalem, it says, "And the Lord gave Joachim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the vessels of the house of God. And he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and placed the vessels in the treasury of his God." So what we know is that Nebuchadnezzar probably just put it in storage in the temple or made it like his trophy case, but we don't know if he ever used them until this feast. So of course it's not as if they ran out of drinking utensils and thus had to resort to drinking out of the temple vessels. So why then do you think Belshazzar chose to do so? What do you suppose he was trying to say with that gesture? So two questions there. So why do you think Belshazzar chose to use the temple vessels? All right, Nick. Okay. Oh, so Nick said it was out of pride, and he wanted to take the temple, the vessels from the temple, and do whatever he wants with it. Yeah, one of the commentators says that it's the triple trouble of wine, women, and worship. Like, all three of those are, not necessarily a bad thing, except, he's doing it in excess, and he's doing it at the wrong, like his worship is towards the wrong object. Well, that's one of the themes in chapter 5, right? It seems like Belshazzar has no idea kind of what has happened in the history of the kingdom so far. It's like, he hasn't definitely not read Daniel chapters 1 to 4. And you mean, so like when Daniel comes, he's kind of saying like, this is what you did? Oh, about the vessels, yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems like he knows, you know, there were vessels that they took from the Jerusalem temple, but he doesn't, like, he hasn't learned the lessons that Nebuchadnezzar learned. Uh-huh, he knew about them. Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. So the kind of the context for this feast here is they say that this was probably like an annual feast to their gods that the Babylonians did, you know, it was an annual feast. And there are kind of two thoughts on kind of why he's doing this in the during the feast. So one is that, you know, the Persian army is at the gate, and he doesn't quite realize that, you know, what's going to happen that night. And so earlier we were talking about kind of how the city of Babylon was built with their walls, and how they boasted that they had these impregnable walls and they had enough food stored in there to feed their population for like 20 years. So Belshazzar is probably assuming, like, you know, the Persians are laying siege to the city, but they'll stay outside the walls, and, you know, eventually the seasons will change. They'll have to deal with, you know, the cold and diseases, and eventually they'll run out of supplies and they'll eventually give up and go. So we can go ahead, have our annual feast, and, you know, we'll do what we need to do, and then eventually we'll sober up and go take care of the enemy. So that's one thought. And then there's also this other thought where, so there's kind of controversy on kind of what is the timeline between when Babylon the city was taken, and when the king, the dad, Nabonidus, surrendered. Because Nabonidus is out there fighting the Persian army in other places. And so some people say that Nabonidus actually surrendered like a couple of weeks before what happened right now in the feast. So, you know, the greater empire's already, like, it's been taken over by the Persians, and these guys are all that once left. So Belshazzar knows that, and this is kind of his, kind of a last attempt to, one, get his kind of nobles fired up to kind of, I guess, fight the enemy outside, and also try to win favor with his gods. So his idea of winning favor with his god is, you know, try to get the vessels from the other gods, which, you know, and then, like, the whole idea of Nebuchadnezzar bringing the vessels from the Jerusalem temple and putting it in his temple is to say that, you know, my god is bigger than your, better than your god. So he's going to go one step further, and he's going to, he knows that, you know, these are kind of consecrated vessels from the temple, and he's going to use them for something that's outside of his original purpose. And also, we see that he's going to praise the gods of gold and silver. So he's going to intentionally do stuff just to see, you know, if that is going to win favor with the gods. And he's also drunk, so he might not necessarily know what he's doing. All right. And the next question is, so why do you suppose, what are you trying to say with this gesture? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so along the lines of kind of the Persian army being outside the gates, I thought maybe he's just trying to relive the good old days where, you know, Nebuchadnezzar went and he had this big victory in Jerusalem, and he got the vessels of the temple out. So I'm gonna, you know, try to relive that, and how, you know, maybe we can restore Babylon to the golden days again. And just show contempt to other cultures and their gods, and, you know, our God's gonna, you know, deliver us from these Persians.
Can I correction real quick? I'm laughing, like, I can't stop.
Well, that is a good point with the names, though, because Belshazzar means that, you know, the Bel, their god, will protect him, and Balthasar, Daniel's name, meant like the lady. It also pretty much is the same name, except there's like it's like a female, like a female something involved in there. But, you know, Bel, the god, did not protect him, and Daniel, who's also supposed to, he's helping him. He's the only one who can interpret the message, but he's not doing it as Belteshazzar. He's doing it as Daniel, the servant of the one true God. And there's big irony in play with their names. All right, so next question. Although Belteshazzar was not literally Nebuchadnezzar's son, the text still refers to Nebuchadnezzar as his father. And why is that? What is the significance to Belteshazzar, to the message of the story, to draw a close connection between these two rulers of Babylon? Anyone have anything? Yeah. Anyone else? No. Yeah, so there's at least Nebuchadnezzar's been dead for 20 to 30 years. You mean the lineage as in... So he's not literally his son, and he's kind of like the fourth king after Nebuchadnezzar, but we have good evidence to believe that he's probably his grandson. So he's still a rightful heir. But does he, though? Like, we don't want to skip ahead, but it seems like until the queen steps in, he didn't know who Daniel was. And just the whole chapter in general, it seems like he did not learn any of the things that Nebuchadnezzar learned. I don't know. I have no idea how old Belshazzar is, but, well, his dad is still alive and he's the emperor, so he can't be that old. And, well, also Daniel actually he basically gives a summary of chapter 4, right, when Daniel comes. We'll get into when Daniel, before he actually interprets the writing, he actually gives a summary of what happened in chapter 4. So it sounds like Belshazzar probably did not know that story. And whether he did or not, he definitely did not learn the lessons that Nebuchadnezzar did. Yeah. Not only that, but he had a dream that said, you're fine, but the guys coming after you are going to be taken over by. So, being a Nebuchadnezzar being a predecessor of Belshazzar, he should know, number one, that God is the true God, because Nebuchadnezzar should have done something about that.
So what he just said, does that kind of answer the question though, that Mike asked us a while ago? Do we think he was saved or not?
Nebuchadnezzar. Yeah, that actually reminded me of the story of Hezekiah and how there's a prophecy that, there's bad things coming, but it won't come to you but for your future generations. And Hezekiah seems totally cool with it. And Hezekiah is one of the, better kings in their history.
You know, it doesn't say that he's my God, my Lord, my God. Now I never deserve the praise and extol and honor the King of Heaven, for all his works are right. His ways are just. Listen to this one. Those who walk in pride, he's able to humble them. Shadrach didn't know that.
And that sequence is actually, if you remember back, was it chapter 2, with Nebuchadnezzar's dream. He had the dream of the great image with all the different, it was made of all the different metals, and it actually is pretty much identical. His image was how it was a head of fine gold, chest and arms of silver, his middle and thighs of bronze, his legs of iron, his feet partly of iron and of clay. And as you looked, the stone was cut out of no human hand. And it stuck the image of his feet of iron and clay. So the only thing missing is clay, but essentially it's the exact same list in the same order. So these guys are essentially almost like worshiping what represents like the future kingdoms that are coming. So he's kind of like inviting the wrath. Because the silver is, we probably understand the silver kingdom as the Persians who are taking over from the Babylonians. All right. So before we leave the feast, one thing I notice is that Daniel is not one of the 1,000 lords who are feasting with the king. Anyone have any kind of thoughts on that? Because Daniel's not there, and then the queen comes in, and then they have to go fetch Daniel. So he's not one of the 1,000 people who are feasting. Mm-hmm. Okay. So you're saying like Daniel's not one of the thousand, mostly like one of the thousand nobles. So if he was, he might have just refused to invite because he knew what they were going to do during, because this is specifically a feast to their Babylonian gods. Or, like Nick said, he might have just been, working a minor role by this time. But we do know that Daniel was still working for, at least in the beginning of the king's, Belshazzar's reign, he was working. If you turn to chapter 8, the very first verse says, "In the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared to me, Daniel." And then you have the whole vision. We don't have to read the vision. And then if you go to the very end of that chapter, in verse 27, it says, "I, Daniel, was overcome and lay sick for some days." This is after he saw the vision. "Then I rose and went about the king's business, but I was appalled by the vision and did not understand it." So this is the third year of Belshazzar's reign, and he is still doing the king's business. But the feast is happening in probably like around year 17 of his reign. So maybe he had kind of some role in the king's, with the king, and then slowly dwindled down, and now he's definitely not the chief of the magicians like Nebuchadnezzar established him. And also he's old and in his 80s. And any other thoughts on just the feast and the vessels before we move on? So one thing I noticed that I forgot to mention is, so there is a decree from Nebuchadnezzar towards the end of chapter 3. So in chapter 3, verse 29, he says, this is Nebuchadnezzar speaking, "Therefore I make a decree, any people, nation, or language that speaks anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb and their houses laid in ruins, for there is no other God who is able to rescue in this way." So this is after, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the fire. And this is Nebuchadnezzar's decree. And just based on this decree, if Nebuchadnezzar were still around, we should know what should happen to Belshazzar for what he's doing with the temple vessels. All right. What was that? All right. We can probably get to section 2. And the thing about Belshazzar is, at least Nebuchadnezzar built the empire. This guy just inherited it, and he probably didn't do much to deserve what he got, and he still has all this money. Exactly, just like how the American president is called the leader of the free world. Like this back then, like Babylonians were essentially the biggest empire the world has ever seen at that point. All right, so let's see if we can get through section 2. An unreadable message. So let me read verses 5 to 9. "Immediately the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace, opposite the lampstand. And the king saw the hand as it wrote. Then the king's color changed. and his thoughts alarmed him. His limbs gave way and his knees knocked together. The king called loudly to bring in the enchanters, the Chaldeans, and the astrologers. The king declared to the wise men of Babylon, "Whoever reads this writing and shows me its interpretation shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around his neck and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom." Then all the king's wise men came in, but they could not read the writing or make known to the king the interpretation. Then King Belshazzar was greatly alarmed, and his color changed, and his lords were perplexed. When Belshazzar sees the fingers of a human hand appearing and writing on the wall, he cannot read the message. Nevertheless, he is overtaken with extreme fear, so much so that his limbs gave way. Why is his immediate reaction one of fear and dread? And also, why does it get worse so that he's greatly alarmed? It actually says alarmed twice. It says that in verse 6, and then he has those enchanters, Chaldeans, and astrologers to come in, and then he's greatly alarmed at the end in verse 9. Anyone else? Well, actually, later on, when Daniel is kind of interpreting, he actually says, let me look at which verse. He says it's. So he's talking about how he's kind of giving a summary of chapter 4. So this is around like verse 23. But basically at the end of verse 23 says, "But the God in whose hand is your breath and whose are all your ways you have not honored, then from his presence the hand was sent." So Daniel's saying clearly, you know, it's the hand from God. Actually, that's something we can explore. So it's called the fingers of a human hand, but Daniel also interprets it to be the finger of God. And this is not the only time in the Bible we see kind of the idea of a finger of God. So can anyone, does it ring a bell to any, yes? The Ten Commandments? Uh-huh. Yeah, that's one of the places. All right, so let me see if I can find my references. So that's in Exodus and Deuteronomy. And then also, if you turn to Exodus 8, Exodus 8:19. So this is in the middle of the Egyptian plagues. And so this is the third plague, the plague of gnats. And so, you know, so the plague happens and the Egyptian magicians are trying to reproduce it. And then the magician said to Pharaoh, verse 19, "This is the finger of God." But Pharaoh's heart was hardened and he would not listen to them, as the Lord has said. Which is actually, it's pretty much like a parallel story to what's going on here. You know, just like the way he tries to get help from the enchanters and stuff. Pharaoh goes to get help from the magicians. They can't do it, but at least they realize it's the finger of God. here these enchanters and Chaldeans and astrologers, they are pretty much, they just walk in the room and then they just walk out without doing any help. And also, there's actually, I also found one in the New Testament, Luke chapter 11. Luke 11, verse 20. So here's Jesus talking about Beelzebub. And I guess I can start. I'll start in 19. If I cast out demons by Beelzebub, by whom do your sons cast them out? Therefore, they will be your judges. But if it is by the finger of God that I cast out demons, then the kingdom of God has come upon you. So here Jesus is casting out demons by the finger of God. And then also, let's go to Psalm 8. Psalm 8, verse 3, it says, when I look at your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have set in place, what is man that you're mindful of him, and the son of man that you care for him? So essentially, you know, just the idea of the finger of God, which Jesus is using to cast out demons, and God, you know, creation is the work of his fingers. And this is in sharp contrast to the Babylonian gods that they were drinking to. If you look at the, like they have these, you know, like these idols, which have, you know, they have hands and feet and a face and everything, but you can see what they are, but they don't do anything. And then you have this invisible God of the universe, and he can bring in a hand and he can write on the wall. And yeah, it could be. Well, I guess I feel like the immediate context is that he's drinking out of those vessels, and he knows that those vessels are from a foreign temple. And, you know, like, even if he doesn't know the history of the, you know, the Hebrew God, he knows that those vessels were created for the specific purpose of worshiping that God. And immediately after you do that, when you see the supernatural thing going on, you probably assume, like, you know, that God had something to do with it. Even if you don't necessarily know what happened to Nebuchadnezzar and, you know, what that God is truly like. From the finger. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good one. All right. We can probably get to the answer for this next time, but as we close, I want to go to, I guess, kind of related to this, like Psalm 115. So they're drinking to the gods of silver and gold and bronze and iron, wood, and stone. And here in Psalm 115, from verses 4, their idols are silver and gold, the work of human hands. They have mouths but do not speak, eyes but do not see. They have ears but do not hear, noses but do not smell. They have hands but do not feel, feet but do not walk. And they do not make a sound in their throat. Those who make them become like them. So do all who trust in them. So, yeah, so this is essentially, you know, what's happening to Belshazzar with. Oops. And also, one other thing before I forget is it actually makes a point to say the lamps, the writing on the wall appeared across the lampstand. And I'm thinking the lampstand's probably another one of the temple vessels that was brought. And we don't have to read it now, but if you go back to like Exodus, when it talks about the lampstand, the lampstand was one of the few items that are actually reserved for the Holy of Holies, where there's the golden table, and in that they're supposed to lay the bread of the presence, and the lampstands were to kind of illuminate the presence, the bread of the presence, and which makes total sense in here, where there's the lampstand, and its purpose there is to illuminate the writing, which is, you know, it's the presence of God there at that moment. And also, which Daniel later confirms in verse 24. And he also, in verse 24, he actually says the hand twice. Or like right before 24, he says how... He says how, but the God in whose hand is your breath, and who are all your ways you have not honored. So here's the hand of God. So here's Belshazzar, he's holding these vessels with his hand, but then, you know, the God of the universe is holding his life in his hands, and he's showing that, you know, through the fingers. So, yes, I guess that's a good place to stop for tonight. Ryan, can you close this?